Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group is hosting a discussion on George Washington University Law School Professor Tom Morgan's recent book, The Vanishing American Lawyer. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Therefore, all expressions of opinions that you will hear are those of the speakers. Now, I need to introduce the speakers for today's podcast, starting with myself as the moderator. My name is William Hodes, Professor Emeritus of Law at Indiana University. I currently maintain a solo law and consulting practice concentrating in the area of legal ethics and professional responsibility, broadly referred to these days as the law of lawyering. I graduated from Rutgers Law School in Newark, New Jersey in 1969, practiced for about 10 years in the private and public sectors, and then taught civil procedure, constitutional law, and professional responsibility at the Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis for the 20 years between 1979 and 1999, when I retired to start my solo practice. I am the co-author with Jeffrey Hazard and Peter Jarvis of a nationally recognized treatise on the model rules of professional conduct entitled The Law of Lawyering. That's how the field of practice got its name. That book was first published in 1985, and it's updated annually. For several years, I was a member of the drafting committee of the Multi-State Professional Responsibility Examination, the MPRE, and I was one of the two co-reporters for the 2007 revision of the ABA Model Code of Judicial Conduct. The first speaker that you will hear, and the author of the book that we are discussing, is Thomas D. Morgan. Tom Morgan is the Oppenheim Professor of Antitrust and Trade Regulation Law at the George Washington University Law School. Before that, he served as dean at the Emory University School of Law and on the faculties of Brigham Young University and the University of Illinois College of Law. Professor Morgan has taught and written in the field of professional responsibility for over 35 years and was one of the first to use the tools of economic analysis to study rules of lawyer regulation and professional ethics. He is co-author of the widely used casebook Problems and Materials on Professional Responsibility, which is now in its 10th edition. And I should add that when I first started teaching professional responsibility in 1979, I used the first or second edition of that text. Tom served as one of the two associate reporters for the American Law Institute's Restatement of the Law Governing Lawyers, and in 1990, he served as president of the Association of American Law Schools. His new book, The Vanishing American Lawyer, which is the subject of our podcast today, was published in February 2010, earlier this year, by the Oxford University Press. The other member of our panel today is Anthony E. Davis. Anthony Davis received his law degree from Cambridge University. That's the university in England, not Massachusetts. An LLM from New York University School of Law. He is admitted to practice in New York and Colorado and still maintains his status as a non-practicing barrister and solicitor in England. Anthony is a partner in Hinshaw and Culbertson LLP's New York office, a key figure in its nationwide Lawyers for the Profession practice group. He advises lawyers and law firms on legal profession and legal ethics issues and in the area of law firm risk management. He is the co-author of two books on risk management, and numerous scholarly articles and bar journal columns. In his spare time, Anthony also lectures at Columbia University School of Law, and he is a member of the American Law Institute and a fellow of the American Bar Foundation. So that brings us to our topic for today, and I'm going to first ask Tom Morgan to give us an overview of the book that is the subject of our discussion. Tom, the title of your book is The Vanishing Lawyer, as has already been mentioned, and that sounds a little scary to me. I'm a lawyer, and it no doubt sounds a little scary to most of the people listening, but the slightly better news is that the subtitle of your book is The Ongoing Transformation of the U.S. Legal Profession, and I take your key point to be not that American lawyers will literally vanish from the scene the way telegraph operators and buggy whip manufacturers have, but rather that they will perform a more limited menu of tasks in competition and also in cooperation with a more varied array of professionals, and that they will practice in something other than the current mega law firm model. Now, in your book, you list eight factors that led you to your basic predictions that I just described. Why don't you start by giving the listeners an overview of maybe two or three of the most important of those continuing developments that led you to your conclusions?
Well, thanks, Bill. I'd begin by confirming your instinct that the provocative title, The Vanishing American Lawyer, does not mean that those of us with law licenses are somehow going to disappear. The idea that the title conveys is that a number of years ago, although not that many, we thought of the term lawyer as describing a particular category of people with a defined set of skills and responsibilities. All of us were trained about the same way, and we were thought to need about the same kinds of skills, including the ability to go to court and to draft a will and so on. That understanding, in turn, has led to a system of regulation that is the same for all people who bear the designation lawyer. We're all regulated by courts, for example. We all take the same bar examination, and we are subject to the same rules of professional conduct. That perception of us all as having so much in common has been the basis for our seeing ourselves as a profession with allegedly common interests, and has caused us to try to make rules to govern ourselves, to have a common representative association or group of associations. And what I'm arguing in the book is that over the last 40 years or so, the underlying reality of the sense of a common body of needs and characteristics of lawyers is what's changed. The idea of the all-purpose lawyer has been replaced by an idea of people who have training in an understanding of the legal system, but who use that training and understanding in a wide variety of ways. And the underlying recommendation of the book is that we quit thinking of regulating lawyers as lawyers and start regulating the situations in which they may appear. That is, the courts might have rules that govern anybody who appears in court, including people we wouldn't today think of as lawyers. We might regulate to people who do deal in the securities business differently than we deal with people who write wills, that there are a whole variety of different ways you come up with thinking about people who engage in the legal world, if you think of them as other than lawyers in a classic sense. What's happened, as you say, I've indicated eight categories, and just to take the most important, one I label globalization. That is a catch or a category that includes two or three different ideas. One is the fact that today the work that individuals with legal training do is more and more complex, and means that even an individual in a relatively small community may find himself or herself dealing not only with state law, as we used to think, but routinely with federal law, and even today, foreign legal systems. That is to say that we have many clients, even from relatively small communities, who have relatives now who live abroad, and any even ordinary dealings involve lawyers in multiple legal systems and cause them to narrow their focus more than they had before. Further, globalization creates a pressure on our clients that is driving those clients to demand more and more for less and less cost. And thus, the globalization phenomenon is putting pressure on lawyer fees that I think will only continue. Finally, when clients do have needs in other countries, they find that there are people in those countries that can help them as well. The systems of regulating people we've been calling lawyers in those other countries are now changing. And as they change, some of the services those other practitioners offer may be more attractive than the services we offer. And as a result, the idea that we have had that somehow we define what being a lawyer is under great pressure. The second category is the heading of technology. The obvious effect is the ease with which clients can now find their lawyers day or night, and the ease with which legally trained people can do basic legal research. But the technology factor also makes it possible to standardize what used to be discrete legal tasks, or discrete tasks such as documenting a deal or preparing a complaint in a case. We've had forms for many years, of course, but now the forms take the form of quite detailed provisions. You can grind out a very lengthy document relatively quickly and relatively inexpensively. When you have that kind of technology, the ability to create a kind of creative drafting process goes away pretty quickly. In addition, clients can do more for themselves today because of technology, whether they're corporations or individuals. The mystery that once surrounded what lawyers did has been broken down as with everything from Google to Wikipedia to all sorts of specialized websites. People can find out that what we do is relatively straightforward and can be broken down and understood by them and indeed done by them to a greater extent than ever before. And finally, the change is in who's buying legal services. 50 years ago, a majority of lawyers worked for individuals and worked in relatively small units. They were solo practitioners or in very small firms. Today, two-thirds of lawyers do work for corporations and other organizations and are, in many cases, in much larger delivery service organizations, law firms or or related kinds of organizations. When the services are bought by in-house lawyers, as they are today, whether in a government agency or a private corporation, the in-house lawyers can do a lot of things themselves or with the assistance of non-lawyers working under their general supervision. What I suggest in the book and what may be disquieting to many is that the outside lawyer that we used to think of as ruling the legal services industry is increasingly going to be in the position of getting the scraps that are left over. And that may mean that even though they don't vanish, they will be significantly less important and less independent than they were before.
Okay, that's great. Anthony, I know you've your very practice, as I described it, is dealing with you know, many of these developments. So I wonder if you could, and I know that you read Tom's book carefully, probably discussed it with him, and you have the jacket blurbs include yours. If you could comment on any of the couple of factors that Tom already mentioned, but also add any one or two that occurred to you to be especially significant, why don't you jump in and start that way?
Well, thank you. I'd like to say this at the beginning. I do urge everybody who listens to this podcast to read Tom's book. I think it's extraordinarily important and thought-provoking. The second thing I want to say is I'm not sure that, Bill, when you introduced and said that you don't think Tom's point is that lawyers will vanish from the scene like telegraph operators and buggy whip manufacturers, I'm not absolutely certain that you're right about that. And I want to take off from some of the things that Tom said to explain why actually I think the very profession itself is actually at risk in the long term of disappearing. I mean, in the 19th century, there were like seven different kinds of lawyers in England, which advocates and attorneys and barristers and sergeants and solicitors, and it gradually reduced to two, and it looks in the long run as if that will reduce to one before lawyers go away in England. And also, by way of backdrop, I want to point out that Tom is not alone in thinking this way about the profession. There's another very important book that readers who find Tom's book interesting may want to look at, and that's Richard Susskind's book, titled even more dramatically, The End of Lawyers, and on the whole subject of regulation. There was a Law Review article that one of our academic colleagues, John Lubsdorf, wrote last year called Legal Ethics Falls Apart, in which he points out that it's not true that there are just 50 states courts regulating lawyers, but there are about 93, and I actually think he missed some, regulatory agencies trying to regulate lawyers today. So we are in a moment of enormous flux in our profession. And now I will take off from some of Tom's points. On the issue of globalization, I think there are several things that need to be said that I'd like to emphasize. First of all, what we are seeing, taking further what Tom said, is what is being called the disaggregation of legal services. Let's go back to one of Tom's comments, that the purchasers of services, the corporate counsel, who are obviously the largest by volume and value purchasers of legal services, are incredibly sophisticated and have available incredibly sophisticated tools. So that when a law firm says, we're going to do due diligence on this acquisition, or we're going to do a document review of the 1 million documents, many of the corporate counsel today will say, no, you're not. we're going to take that piece of work away from you, and we're going to send it not necessarily even to lawyers, but to a service provider in the Philippines or in South Africa or in India who will employ people who charge us $25 an hour, who are native English speakers, who we train specifically for that task, and we are thereby going to cut by about 95% what you would previously have charged us. And that's not the only service that lawyers have traditionally done that is being taken away, and if you prefer plain English, to disaggregation. To go to another of Tom's comments, there is now very, very powerful software that some firms are already starting to use that enable them to put together all of the documentation for major transactions using precedents within firms' memory bank in less than an hour, work that would have taken a team of lawyers several days or weeks before. So that the whole pricing and the whole production of the product is changing. And that which was viewed as high-end legal work a year ago or 5 years ago very quickly becomes a commodity. So that there is in fact going to be less and less work of the kinds that teams of lawyers used to do that require teams. Now that's just talking about globalization and moving work abroad and simplifying it. It ties together his point about technology and globalization. I want to make two more points, and then I'll back off for a bit. On globalization, there's another threat to lawyers, or at least a perceived threat, and that is the way that lawyers are being regulated in other parts of the world is changing very dramatically. And to take one instance, in the English Legal Services Act of 2007, English lawyers are expressly going to be permitted, beginning next year in 2011, to raise money from outside investors in law firms, so that non-lawyers are explicitly going to be permitted to invest in law firms, a situation that already exists in parts of Australia. And even more interestingly, in my view, English lawyers are going to be permitted to enter into business relationships, partnerships, or corporate entities in which equal voting partners are non-lawyers. And that is going to create even more pressure for the delivery of services in different ways. And except for the District of Columbia, those kind of direct relationships are, in most American jurisdictions, outright forbidden. And that, in my view, in the long run, unless we change the American regulatory system entirely, which we can come back to if you want, is going to leave those big customers with the interesting question as to whether they want to bother to continue to employ American lawyers when they can go to London and get a variety of services in one package, presumably, therefore, more efficiently and more cheaply. And one more thing to say about technology. Tom's points in the book, rightly, focus on the way that existing technologies are changing the way lawyers perform their function. I would just like to throw out one thought from Richard Susskind's book that goes to your buggy whip manufacturing analogy, Bill. Richard Susskind talks about disruptive technologies. Now, once upon a time, lawyers thought email was a disruptive technology, but they've learned to co-opt it. But a disruptive technology is one which renders the whole business that we used to do totally irrelevant. That's why we don't have buggy whip manufacturers, because we have automobiles. And we don't have telegraph operators, because we have the internet, if you will. Now, it's hard to predict what the disruptive technologies will be, but we do know certain things about technology, including the fact that it's fairly clearly evident from existing research that the memory power of a computer that will sit on your desk in 10 years from now will actually equal the memory power of the human brain. And if it's not 10 years, it'll be 20 years. This sort of tells us that there are going to be changes of even greater dimension that make many of the things that lawyers do redundant. It goes to Tom's point that a great deal of what lawyers have done in the past can in fact be done by non-lawyers. There was a piece in this last weekend's New York Sunday Times about the software programs that you can buy off the shelf to write your will. And the article basically said, these products are pretty good, but they do make the occasional mistake, so you might want to have a lawyer look at it. Now, what that means is that instead of charging a whole lot of money to go through or spend a great deal of time going through facts from potential estate planning clients and drafting a will and reviewing it with a client and charging a lot of money, the estate planner of the future better have a big volume business because he or she is going to be looking at precast documents prepared by clients and will probably not get paid for more than half an hour's work.
Right.
That's not a disruptive technology. That's merely the extension of existing technology. But my point is to amplify what Tom said, that a great deal of what lawyers have done in the past, they will not be able to charge clients anything for very soon.
Right. I think that's something that I want to come back to towards the end, because the last point, the example that Anthony gave about information technology, that the brain power of lawyers has now been supplanted by readily available documents and forms on the internet. That has a huge impact on the whole concept of unauthorized practice of law. People who operate, who provide that kind of information technology, obviously will say, I'm not practicing law, I'm just providing information. You can do with it what you want. But before we get to that, I noticed in the two opening presentations that there's a slight difference between the two of you about whether the extent of the prognosis, whether lawyers are vanishing like the telegraph operator or whether they're merely transforming. But let's put that aside, and I'd like to ask you, Tom, let's assume that you're, well, that both of you are right, that there are developments pushing towards towards making the law license less valuable, disaggregation, and so on. Assuming that those trends continue for quite some time, and they're likely to accelerate, if anything, what in your vision will the typical lawyer in fact be doing 15 years from now or so? And then I'd like, sort of as a second incorporated question, I wonder if both you and Anthony could comment on the distinction that you see, if any, between what lawyers in large cities, large firms with international practices and so on, what they will be doing versus what the something more like the old-fashioned lawyer living in either in a wholly rural area or really a very quite small town, who does not work for a large institution, is not called upon by in-house counsel to do little bits and pieces of their work. But let's start, Tom, if you would, with what you see the typical lawyer doing, you know, in the next period when all of us have retired?
Well, I think the first point to see, Bill, is that there are going to be a lot fewer typical lawyers, if indeed there'll be. I won't ever say it'll be zero, but it's going to approach zero. What I'm predicting is that the world is going to employ many, many fewer people whose principal skill is bringing legal insight to the client. The people who are going to succeed, today's lawyers who are going to succeed in the future, are people who will be seen as the very best at specialized tasks that involve bringing what we might call non-legal insights to bear on a problem, but being able to add their understanding of how the legal system works. For example, what I tell law students today is that if you want to go into health law, for example, you better be a nurse at least, and maybe even have additional training, because the real people who are going to be differentiated and successful are going to be successful because of what they bring in addition to their lawyer insight, their ability to understand the client's problem from the inside. And so my short answer to your question is that lawyers are going to have to move more and more into specialized areas and more call upon either their pre-legal training or their experience over the course of their career to date, or some additional post-law school training, to have the sort of specialized understanding that will allow them to bring non-legal insights to the problem, and thus be able to more quickly, more efficiently, with more understanding, address the problem of the individual clients. I think that the lawyer in your small town that you talk about is primarily going to become somebody who has a lot of contacts, either through referral networks or other kinds of devices that we will develop, to be able to get his neighbor or fellow citizen connected with the kind of people I'm describing. There will always be some need for what various people have called high-touch services. People like to not deal completely by email or over the internet. And there will be a place for a nice person in a small town who can listen to the problem and then get the client the help they really need. But the idea of the small town lawyer who does everything for anybody is, I think, vanishing very quickly.
Okay, before I turn those same two questions over to Anthony, I just want to follow up on one the last part of what you said, Tom, and that is, what's your view about in the small town? Will there still be, in your view, any significant need for the sort of the small time generalist? That is to say, not somebody who all they need is just to close on their new house or a very simple divorce or something, you know, fairly mundane, by, you know, one farmer selling a piece of farm equipment to somebody else. Those people don't need to be connected with the absolute top of the line specialist. What is the role of those kind of people going to be?
I agree with Anthony that those people are likely to primarily use forms. I wouldn't put down the experience or specialization in the handling of of major farm machinery transactions. That is, you can imagine that there's a lot of money that turns on some of those, and it may be that there will be especially there. But I think what you're going to find is that the person you have in mind, the small town practitioner, is going to be A, the high touch interface between the client and the legal system, B, the person who gets the client in touch with somebody who really does a lot of these things, and that there's going to be relatively low compensation for that activity.
Okay, and that would include divorce, sort of small-time divorces and that kind of thing as well.
Well, an enormous number of those, if they're uncontested, really can be done largely with forms. To the extent they're contested and all, then it and to the extent there's real financial assets at stake, that again will be an area that I think will require some specialization and will not be the sort of thing that the local guy in the small town or woman in the small town just does routinely.
Okay. Anthony, do you have any further takes on that aspect?
Yes, I have lots of takes on, and I'm actually going to tackle it for a reason you'll see in the reverse order. Number one, it doesn't matter where you sit and work today. My secretary is permanently stationed 2,000 miles from where I sit. We function perfectly well. I serve clients all over North America. Sitting here, I do travel. But the fact is, one of the things technology has done is remove boundaries. One way to think about the small town lawyer is there are plenty of people who've moved but who still do sophisticated work, having nothing to do with the place where they sleep at night. Secondly, I would like to go further than Tom and you in terms of what the person who wants to serve a small rural community will be doing. I would like to suggest this. I'll make a prediction. 20 years from now, there will only, if you want to get what we think of as legal services, you will go to Walmart and you will find a little segment there, like you can find a coffee shop or an ATM machine, and you will find someone who will give you at a very low cost the interface that Tom mentioned that you need with whatever part of the system you need some help with. And let's just talk, we haven't mentioned, except in this context of a divorce, dispute resolution. Litigation is becoming a fundamentally uneconomic proposition in the vast majority of cases today. And there are lots of reasons for that. We don't have time to go into it. But what we're starting to see as a result, again, using technology, is dispute resolution happening through mediation-type services on the Internet without the intervention of lawyers at all. And in my view, that is increasingly going to be true, because I think litigation is indeed going to go the way of buggywick manufacturing. It just doesn't make sense to do it the way we're trying to do it now, and it cannot go on the way it's going on now. And so there may be a very, very, very small cadre of people who do a high-end dispute resolution, but I suspect that that is going to fade away in the next 20 years. I may be completely wrong. I certainly think it's going to be done completely differently. But I really do think that the word interface that Tom used is probably the key. I think the need for lawyers is going to focus on compliance with regulations and helping clients of all kinds comply with the law. Now, the fact is that I'm not convinced that lawyers will end up doing that unless they recognize the need to change the direction of how they're trained and what they do. But in effect, if we go back to the word disaggregation, if lawyers want to survive and not to vanish, they'd better be the aggregators, the people who pull together all the other pieces so that clients get outcomes that they want, whether it's deals, contracts, whether it's compliance with regulation by government entities, whether it's resolution of a dispute. They'd better be the ones pulling the strings. But what I'm trying to say is I'm by no means convinced that we are well poised to be there because of the very over-regulated but totally misunderstood structure of regulation that we have. I think we may regulate ourselves out of existence.
Well, okay, I think you've really made a nice segue into the area that I said I wanted to go into a little earlier, but also with its close cousin, Anthony. So I'm going to ask Tom about the implications for all of these developments, both for the issue of unauthorized practice and for the issue when you talk about being the aggregator, the issue of what was sometimes called multidisciplinary practice or having lawyers and other professionals working together. If it's really true that there's going to be a lot of things that are spun off to either internet providers or other providers that require technological skills, as you said, require some legal savvy, but do not require full-scale legal education followed by a bar exam and a character and fitness review and so on, what are the prospects, do you think, that the ABA will soften its positions on unauthorized practice, for one, and then the ban on sharing fees with non-lawyers in various kind of joint enterprises?
Well, it seems to me that the ABA is unlikely to lead in this, just based on their past history. But I don't think that what the ABA thinks about it has much to say about the way things are going to turn out. I use an example in the book of toll collectors at a bridge, which used to be thought of as one of the really secure jobs in life. That bridge was one of the few ways across the river, and everybody had to take the toll bridge, and everybody had to stop at the booth and pay the toll collector. So we used to think that a toll collector, if you get that job, you had it for life. Then the Easy Pass came along, and people can drive at highway speed through the detector and pay their toll electronically, and the toll booth collector industry disappeared. That's the phenomenon that Anthony's talking about and that I'm talking about. The folks who were involved in being in running the Toll Booth Collectors Union were not of much significance with respect to the question of what you do when technology and reality overtakes your industry. I think that one of the interesting features of this is the fact that regulation of the legal profession is done by state supreme courts, who are made up of judges who don't really experience the problems directly themselves, and so they may be among the slowest to act. I suspect that the ABA, however, and state bar associations, as they begin to wake up to what's going on and what's likely to accelerate, may recognize that if they're to have any effect at all, they've got to get out ahead of the parade instead of try to slow it down, and that ultimately the regulations will change simply because the lawyers who find themselves unable otherwise to address the issues will demand that their representatives and their associations get out in front and help remove some of the strictures on their conduct.
Well, I wanted to ask Anthony to respond with respect to the ABA and its role in all of this, because I know you're active in the ABA, and I saw a most interesting phenomenon on this most in the most recent issue, September issue of the ABA Journal. There's an article about some of the kinds of things we've been talking about, particularly the industry that Tom and Anthony, you both have talked about, that investment capital is in the billions, is already funding these disaggregating services, especially with respect to electronic discovery and some of the other aspects of it. But in that article, there was a quote from and some comments by the immediate past president of the ABA, Carolyn Lamb, who's only been out of office 1 month or maybe two. And she was, now that she's out of office, seemed to be taking no worse than a sort of agnostic view of, well, maybe these kinds of things, you know, will happen after all. And I wanted to ask you specifically, Anthony, because I think you're involved with that as well. Carolyn Lamb was also the president of the ABA who convened what's referred to as the Ethics 2020 Commission that is now examining a lot of these same kinds of developments that we are in Tom's book and that we've been discussing here today. What do you think the prospects are that the Ethics 2020 Commission will sort of become an agent of change, if I can call it that?
All right. I'm going to be very harsh, but I want to say this, that if I sound very harsh, I hosted a panel this week at which Michael Trainor, one of the co-chairs, was present. So they know that I think this way. And I am going to present some evidence to them, but I don't think it'll help. The 2020 Commission, in my view, is a bit like the orchestra on the Titanic on the night that the ship hit the iceberg. They're playing the right tune, but they simply don't have the power, and they're part of an institution that is incapable of directing the kinds of changes that are needed. To give you a very simple example, we were all involved in different ways 10 years ago in amending the model rules to allow for the for lawyers in one jurisdiction to temporarily practice in another jurisdiction, 5.5. 10 years later, there are still six states, including New York, the greatest center of lawyers in the country, that have not adopted 5.5. Now, why am I singling that out? Because to the extent we do have regulators of the profession that are in any sense unified, we have 50 separate regulators, and the ABA is, if you like, the conductor for the regulators. But having 50 separate regulators of the profession may have made sense when the fastest means of communication by lawyers or clients was on the back of a horse. But we left that era about 190 years ago. And the ABA's role, the ABA membership, the House of Delegates of the ABA is comprised of whom? It's comprised of members of state delegations, of state bar associations. So you cannot look to the ABA to make the kinds of change that are essential. I mean, first of all, just as the English have totally restructured their regulatory system, one of the primary goals of re-regulation to enhance competition in the provision of legal services in the UK, that is impossible in the United States. I wrote an article that came out recently in the American Lawyer Online edition in which I said, we can get nowhere unless and until we have a single regulator nationally. I'm afraid that the 2020 Commission doesn't have the power, and although I greatly respect, I know very well personally half of the members of the Commission, and they're good friends, and I respect them dearly, but they don't stand a chance.
Okay, well, I'm going to wrap up with a concluding thought. I was going to ask about the role of the state Supreme Courts in this, but I think you already responded to that. If I can summarize, it sounds as if the ABA, which is often sort of a spark plug to get things going, is really not terribly anxious to be the engine of change. And the state Supreme Courts, even if there was only one of them, they also, it can be argued, are the people who have risen to the top of the heap under the old system and are probably don't have a great appetite for change, but sort of, you know, time will tell as to whether change will force itself upon us, as former ABA President Carolyn Lamb seemed to be saying. But my concluding question for both of you, and it may sounds like there may be, again, a slight difference between you, but not a great one, and that is sort of the philosophical approach to what findings Tom and many others have made along these lines. And I characterize it this way. Tom has been criticized, I think, and I saw a short piece in one of the American Bar Association journals in the Professional Lawyer. Tom has been, in effect, criticized for being defeatist, or he's saying, well, if you can't beat all of these 6, 7, 8 huge changes that are coming down the pike and are already here, then you might as well join it. But some within the ABA, maybe on the state Supreme Courts, some within the profession generally, have argued, and with great passion, and I think in good faith for sure, that unless lawyers remain controlled more by internal professional norms than by pure market forces, then whatever is left of the legal profession in Tom's new world won't be worth anything anyway. We'll have lost our soul, so to speak. What's your reaction, both of you, to that sort of longer-term attitude towards the changes that we think might be coming?
So that Tom gets the last word, can I go next?
Well, sure, that makes sense.
Yeah. My answer to that is this, and again, I know that my funny accent makes me sound like I support the English, and I've been an American citizen for over 3 decades, and I've only really seriously practiced here since the mid-70s. So I'm not just a knee-jerk Brit, despite my accent. What is fascinating about the origin of the 2007 English Act is that it came out of government as a result of enormous pressure from the consumer movement. Huge dissatisfaction with the way legal services were being presented and priced and regulated. But what has come out of that is a system where the government has said, you can regulate yourselves however you want. And if you want to have different regulators for different parts and groupings in your profession, you can. You just have to report to one overarching regulator who regulates regulators. That's complicated. You have to show that you have maintained your core values within whatever structure you choose to operate. So that I am totally understanding of and sympathetic with the idea that there are some core values that have to be addressed. I am also enormously of the view that the market, and in that sense technology and globalization are the market, is going to determine the form in which we operate. That does not prevent us from regulating ourselves in ways that maintain traditional values to the degree the market demands those values. So I don't see an inconsistency. What I see, however, is an attempt to hold back the waves, like King Canute, by the existing regulators, that is bound to fail.
Okay, Tom, by edict of Anthony, you get the last word.
Well, thanks, Bill, and thanks to both you and Anthony for this for your participation in this podcast, which I think has brought out the issues very well. I think it is appropriate to end here on the question of character and fundamental values. I just don't believe there is any real fundamental value in fighting against the reality that our clients are facing. Lawyers are primarily, have been for the duration of the legal profession, trying to serve the interests of their clients and do so in the world that their clients have to address. I agree with everyone who says that professionalism in the sense of integrity and personal character, that kind of professionalism is something that lawyers ought to preserve, just as every other occupational group ought to try to preserve them. Mine is not a call for cutting corners on honesty or any other important value and character trait. I just don't think it adds anything to call those traits professional or unique to lawyers. The law has always protected people against overreaching by those in a position to take advantage of them, and those and lawyers have been seen to be in that position in many cases. To the extent that we are in a position to take advantage of our clients, we ought to be regulated, but not by regulations that happen to work in Abraham Lincoln's day. There is no virtue in that sense in the good old days. The object is to try to understand what our clients need tomorrow and conform our behavior and our professional standards to those needs. And when we do that, we're going to find that the lawyer in the past that we've known in the past really has vanished for the reasons we've talked about this afternoon.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank both of you for participating, and I learned a lot. I hope the listeners did, and I want to then say to the listeners to thank them for listening as well if they've gotten this far. We hope you've enjoyed the Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, you can visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. That's federalistsociety, all one word, .org/multimedia. Thanks to everyone.